Hi, everybody. This is Brad with the United Way of Columbia and Greene Counties. You are listening to WGXC ACRA, Columbia and Greene Counties, 90.7 on the dial.
WGXC welcomes audio responses and feedback from listeners. Anyone can call and leave a message, and we'll play it on the air. Call 518-622-2598 and leave up to a 3-minute message for airplay. That number again is 518-622-2598.
WGXZ underwriting support is provided in part by MPAC, presenting the U.S. premiere of Permanent Trespass, Beirut of the Balkans and the American Century, a performance by filmmaker Bassem Saed and writer Sanja Grozdanik. Friday, October 25th at 7 p.m. on the campus of RPI in Troy, New York. Information can be found at mpac.rpi.edu.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Ava Pepe in Round Top, New York. WGXC monthly supporters care deeply about Creative Community Radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
What else do DJs get? I mean, we're just voices in the air, but we're what makes radio live. What do we get for it? Seems like every year you pack everything up, move to another town, gets harder.
Thank you. You are listening to Frequency. Meet bird people in Hudson Valley on Waveforms WGXC 90.7 FM. And my name is Mayuko. We started today's show with a track released last month by Glasgow-based Turkish musician and sound designer İsik Kürar. And the track was titled Birds of the Evening from the album Moon in Gemini. And I said meet bird people in Hudson Valley, but this episode actually is a special UK edition because I was traveling there for most of October. And so my guest is Rachel Winkworth. She's an artist and avid birder who lives in Montrose in Scotland. The love of birds has been in her family for generations, passed down in the forms of nature books, some dating back to the late 19th century, and also encouragements for the power of observation. Her family stories also give us a glimpse of what birding was like without binoculars and also internet, I would like to say, in early to mid-20th century England. And so we're going to hear her treasured memories of birds, beginning with her childhood in the New Forest in England, and also a story of her grandmother, who was a working woman and a single mother who traveled the world, literally traveled the world, in the 1930s with her bird guides in hand. So I hope you enjoy this interview. Thanks for tuning in. This is Frequency on WGXC.
My name's Rachel Winkworth, and I live in Montrose in the county of Angus in Scotland, although I haven't always lived there. That's my home now.
And you were originally born?
In the south of England, in a town called Fareham in Hampshire.
And so that's where you spend a lot of time with your family, your childhood.
Well, I was about 4 years old when we left Fareham, and we moved to a small market town, also in Hampshire, called Ringwood. Mm-hmm. And we lived there for about 9 years. My father was a policeman, so he moved with his job. And as children, we, you know, the family, we all moved to Ringwood. And then from there, we moved to a village called Sway, which is also in Hampshire, and it's in the New Forest. Within the confines of the New Forest, right on the very edge of it, the southwestern edge. And we lived there for about 10 years. And so you could say we grew up in Hampshire, close to the New Forest, or in the New Forest, which is a large forest which used to be a hunting ground for the king at the time, going back to centuries ago.
Right, you had a book of New Forest.
Yes, yes. It's it was by John R. Wise. It's called The History of the New Forest, and it was published in about 1868, the first edition. And my mother had two copies. One was given to my sister, mm-hmm. and I had one, which was a third edition, mm-hmm. Published in 1888. Yeah.
Right. When I was visiting your place, you had lots of books that's all from your family members, the bird books and nature books.
Yes.
And so we were chatting about how your parents loved nature and how their love of nature nurtured you to become a birder. So I wanted you to talk about, you know, how you started birding. And
yes. Well, we were quite young. My mother and father, they both loved nature and would encourage us to read about it. And if we saw a bird, then we would have to find out what it was. And we would buy a bird book, or they would buy it for Christmas for us or for our birthdays, because we didn't have a lot of money. So in the days before the internet, that was the way that we identified our birds. Also, I joined the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds when I was quite small. I was about 8 years old, I think. Maybe nine, but I still have my old Royal Society for the Protection of Birds identification. It's like a little chart book. So when you saw a bird, you would put a tick against it, and where you saw it, the date that you saw it, the time you saw it. It was very basic, but it sort of encouraged us to make notes about what we saw. And my father was good at woodwork, so he would made us a bird table. And it was in the garden at Ringwood that I remember the bird table being placed. And we would see birds like a hawfinch on the bird table. The ordinary birds, sparrows, goldfinches, greenfinches, chaffinches, you know, wrens, robins, blackbirds, thrushes. All these birds would visit the garden. And, I mean, a hawfinch today would be quite a rare sight. But in those days, it was probably quite common.
And this is around what year?
Would be about 1960. The winter of 1962 was a very cold and very snowy winter. It went down in the record books as being a very bad winter. And it went right through till early 1963. There was a lot of snowfall all over Great Britain. It was so cold that the sea froze in various parts of the country, and it had a great effect on the birds' population. And I remember making a note in my little RSPB book about a blackbird with only one leg, and my parents told me it would have been because its leg was frozen. And the blackbird had lost the leg because of the severe weather. So this blackbird, I did a little drawing of it, a little sketch, and that's still in the book today, but I'm not able to find it at the moment, but it's still there. And also there was a story that went around then about the wren. So the wren was very vulnerable because of its size. But what they used to do, they would they found that wrens were roosting together in a ball so that they would keep warm. Up to about 50 wrens could be found in a roosting somewhere, like, I don't know, a little hole in the wall or something like that, and they would all pile in and keep themselves warm together.
It must have been quite a sight.
Yes, it would. I never saw it, but I remember the parents were, or it may have been on the radio or something, I heard it.
If it's so historically cold, you have to be friendly all of a sudden.
Yes, we've all sorts of strangers in there, but they it was survival, you know, and I hope it worked. Yeah,
that's
so funny. That was that. And then, you know, we just made, year by year, we made, I made little notes about what I'd seen. And then, of course, when you become a teenager, your parents don't have, you know, they give you a little bit more freedom.
Right.
And then you don't keep up your notes. So that was a period when I stopped. But I still kept the keenness of looking for birds. And it was just a sort of a thing which wasn't just going out and seeing as many birds as you want to go and see. And I never made, you know, the tick lists that people had today. It was more just a deep love of seeing whatever bird it was, the commonest bird, you know. And also it was about flight and about the ability of birds to fly and be free from the land, be free from, you know, it's just the freedom that you have in flight, you know. I always thought it was, you know, fantastic that birds could be so free and also have a hard life, I know, just to keep alive. But so, yes, that was that. And then when I was a little bit older, I sort of went out on my own a lot, down to marshy places down on the south coast of England, where you'd see all sorts of birds and waders and all that kind of thing. And I remember one day going down to a little town on the south coast called Lymington, where there are marshlands. And there was a report went round before the internet. You had little newsletters and things, I think. And there were snow buntings down in Lymington marshes. So we went down. I went down and actually saw them. Yeah. So that was very nice. Yeah. But over the years, I've kept my love of birds. But all when you're working and you don't always have the time. But right. It's a great thing to go out and just be free of just to sort of observe things. You'll go on a walk, you'll go into the forest, or you'll go down by the sea. That's what I really thank my parents for, mm-hmm. is the power of observation. Mm-hmm. Always to look at what you when you're out, look and around you and see what's around you. A lot of people today just don't look and see the tiny little things mm-hmm. in nature, like little beetle or, you know, a rare butterfly or anything, you know, flowers, wildflowers. It's quite sad, I think, that a lot of people don't have these interests anymore.
Yeah, totally. I started birding as an adult, so I know you don't just know how to see things and observe things. You kind of have to be taught to pay attention. Yes. And so it took me some time for me to finally get around there, but I'm glad I did.
If you're just joining us, today's guest is Rachel Winkworth, an artist and a birder based in Montrose, Scotland. Thanks for listening. This is Bequency on WGXE, a special UK edition.
Have you always had binoculars since you
see, we didn't have a lot of money, and I mean, binoculars would have been expensive even back in the early 60s.
Oh, yeah.
But I remember one pair that my father bought me at an auction sale at an old house, and it was when they were in, they moved, and they lived in Somerset for a little while, mm-hmm. and there was some old house there which had a house sale, and he bought this pair of, I think they were military binoculars, but they were quite compact, mm-hmm. and I had them for many years, and they were my first-class binoculars, second-hand, quite old, but they worked, and so that I treasured them, and then one day I dropped them, and it broke the prism, you know. And that was that. But I kept them, nevertheless, you know, mm-hmm. I kept them. But and it's only in recent years that I've had a couple of pairs of good binoculars. I don't have a telescope, but I just, you know, manage with binoculars. Yeah, it's good.
But if you have the patience to just look and observe, you could get some insights of birds' behaviour and all.
Yes,
that.
Yes. Just, I remember once when I was a child going up to a place near where we lived, walking along a lane and hearing a little wren singing in the hedgerow, and I stopped and looked in, and there was I saw a little wren's nest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things like that stick in your mind. And also we love natural history. I mean, I remember taking a grass snake home to show my mum and dad in a paper bag. Mm. And they were horrified, but of course they knew it was okay, but they made me take it back to where I found it and release it, you know. But things like that, we just were fascinated by nature, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another thing to mention about books is that my mother and father used to, at Christmas, they would buy me a bird book or something like that, you know, when I got a little bit older. And when I was 10, I had one at Christmas, which was a lovely one with the illustrations by, it's one of the famous old artists whose name I can't remember, but there were most beautiful colour illustrations in this book. And my mother had several bird books that she used, you know, and we'd annotate on the pages where we'd seen a rare bird. Mm-hmm. We'd annotate what we'd seen. I remember when we were going up to Derbyshire before the M1 was built, and we used to go all the way through the countryside up to see my grandmother, mm-hmm. My father's mother, and seeing birds en route that we'd make notes of. I remember seeing a Montagu's Harrier, which today is very rare. Mm. But those are the things we would make a note of in our bird books. So alongside the description of the bird, you'd have, you know, your handwritten, the date you saw it, where you saw it, you know. And there's a lot of that going on there. I remember when I was 9, going to a place called Harbridge near Ringwood, where we used to live. Beautiful area of marshland alongside the River Avon. And there were a lot of snipe, redshank, all sorts of waders and wildfowl there. But then the exciting thing that we saw there was a water rail. Mm-hmm. And I never forgot it. It was in a boggy ditch with a little stream running through it. And we were sort of on this little bridge, and we looked over, and there was this little water rail with a red beak, and it was just a lovely sight. We were so excited, you know, because we'd never seen one before. Mm-hmm. Things like that, you know, you never forget. And it's only recently, since I've moved to Scotland, that I've seen them again, you know, quite often, so... That was very good. So bird books, I had the Observer's Book of Birds, and I had this lovely little book that I showed you the other night, mm-hmm. who was some artist I can't remember the name of, but and then I had another one which was called Watching Wildlife, and it was how to observe foxes, deer, badgers, stoats, and all this weasels and their footprints, to observe them with the wind in the right direction so that your scent wouldn't go to them.
Wow.
So the scent would have to go coming towards you. Mm-hmm. You know, all these little things, and what their footprints look like, you know, all this sort of thing. I was absolutely thrilled with it. I still got it now.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. So then when my mother was small, she was given a bird book by her mother, my grandmother.
Right.
And it's a lovely book, which I've still got. It was my grandmother's book. She was given it when she was 10 years old. And then when my mother was 10 years old, she gave it to her. Mm-hmm. And then when my mother died in 1999, she gave it to me. It bequeathed it to me, you know. Mm-hmm. So I've still got it. And it's a book which is written by a very famous writer of the day, going back to the Edwardian era, late Victorian Edwardian, W.H. Hudson. And he's well known in Britain as being a famous writer of natural history and also country life, mostly in the southern counties. And then another bird book I've got, which is a real gem, is Birds of Great Britain, I think, but it also includes the Egyptian vulture and
right,
some other vulture. Yeah,
like, yeah. How are they included?
Yes.
British Empire all over the world.
Probably, but it's got a beautiful cover. It's sort of dark red, and it's got gold tooling on the cover on the spine. It's got a golden eagle in gold relief, right. You know, on the front. And most lovely, I thought, well, they're woodcuts. They could be woodcuts, but they're really beautifully done. And some of them are hand-tinted in watercolour. Mm-hmm. So it's a very precious book to me.
It's a very beautiful book.
It is. It's a real gem. But my parents bought it in the county town of Wiltshire, Salisbury, in a bookshop called Beecher's, mm-hmm. which was situated in the heart of the old city of Salisbury, near the cathedral, right on the corner of a crossroads. And I remember it was a old timbered, half-timbered building. fact, my parents used to go there quite often because they loved old books. Mm-hmm. And so we were taken along too. And it just gave us our love of books, my sister too. And we'd go in, and it was like going on board an old galleon. You had creaking timbered floorboards, which were sagging, and these old bookcases all on the ground floor, little corners where you had bookcases at right angles and all different subjects. And we'd always go to the natural history ones, and that's where they got this lovely book for me, which I treasure. Yeah.
If you're just joining us, today's show is a special UK edition of Bequency, and my guest is Rachel Winkworth, an artist and a birder based in Montrose, Scotland. Thanks for listening.
And from my mother, she told me that my grandmother also loved birds, mm-hmm. which seems funny that it must be inherited. Must be in the blood or something.
Well, even it's though, handed down to... Yeah,
well, yes, yeah. Yes, that's more like it, really. Mm-hmm. My grandmother, who I never knew, because she died in 1949. Mm-hmm.
Do you know when she was born?
When? She was born in 1895, mm-hmm. in County Dublin, in Southern Ireland. She lived there for some years. I mean, because I never knew her or her parents or any of the family, there's a lot of guesswork involved. So
right.
it's difficult to give an accurate history of her Irish life. But mm-hmm. she did go to school in Exeter, in Devon. And I know she was confirmed in Exeter Cathedral. And so she had some... family friends in Devon, and then she was a nurse during the First World War. I don't know any details of it, only a small photograph that my mother had in the album, and
that's quite a lot of photos actually from that time period.
Yes, very lucky, although I don't know who took them all, you know,
right.
and it's all a bit of a mystery, but it's a fascinating mystery.
Right. So you said it's a guesswork, but it's based on a lot of... You have some materials
yes.
to make the guesses based
yes.
on.
Yes, and I've had help from a friend who has done some research, but it's not a full sort of research, you know. But anyway, so she, after the First World War, I presume she lived in Dublin or thereabouts in County Dublin, and then... she joined the Merchant Navy around about 1926, and she went to sea, and she was on the old Strathboats, they called them, or the ships that they were passenger ships, but also I think they were mail ships. The old P&O line was founded in 1837, and she actually went through the Second World War as a merchant seaman, and she got the Atlantic Star and the Pacific Star, which were awarded to merchant seamen who had completed certain Atlantic or Pacific journeys 6 months. They had to have done it for 6 months to achieve the medal after the war. So I only knew this because I inherited her medal bar, mm-hmm. and I think my nephews got her medals. The Pacific Star medal was given because they did a lot of troop runs. They did the they took troops, New Zealand and Australian, I think, mm-hmm. from the Solomon Islands, and then I suppose the Atlantic would have been to America. Obviously, America, New York, perhaps, and I don't know.
There were many photos of even Japan and Hong Kong, and
yes.
I wonder when those photos of Japan was taken, because if it was the Second War, I don't know how she could have landed in...
Well, that would have been during the time that she joined in 1926 through till 1939.
Uh-huh.
Because she... died in 1949,
right,
after the Second World War. So those were in the peacetime interval between the two wars.
So those must have been the time. Because there are lots of like street scenes and...
Well, if you remember, some of them are 1933.
Right.
It's actually written in the book by her.
Right.
So she must have visited them in 1933.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them, I think, are postcards, not actually taken by her.
Right.
But I know she had a camera. Mm-hmm. Some of the smaller ones, perhaps, were taken by her.
It's so extraordinary thing to think about, that she had a job.
Mm.
I mean, we don't know how she applied for this job.
No.
But she seemed to be a really independent woman. She was traveling all over the world, you know, watching birds, I would like to think, and looking at all these foreign countries and very adventurous person. And she was also a...
I think she had a spirit of adventure in her. That's why she wanted to do it. Mm-hmm. And I think she wanted to see the world, because I think her brother was in Ceylon before the war, something to do with... he was a civil servant, so whether that had anything that influenced her to want to go and see the world, you know, maybe. But yes, she had a spirit of adventure, definitely.
And she was also a single mom.
It must have been very
bold
hard
choice at that time.
And from our modern day perspective, we look down and we could criticise her for leaving her daughter in the care of good friends, but not seeing her very often.
Mm-hmm.
And when she did come back, she would bring her gifts, you know, and things like that. But she didn't get the home care and love and attention from her mother. But then when you think of it, you think it was such a taboo thing to do in those days, to have a child out of wedlock. And because her family were quite, probably, you know, Victorian in their outlook.
And
also there was a certain status of the family to take into consideration, you know. Mm-hmm. That she was set adrift and would have to have earned her own keep. And in order to do that, to support her child, maybe she... I don't know whether that's true, because when my mother was born was after she was already, or was she, I don't know, I wouldn't like to say, but it could be that she felt she had to continue
for financial reasons,
yeah, let's say that, and that she was trying to do her best for her child. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd like to think of it in that way.
It is hard to tell, because, you know, she, because we don't know what options she had at the time. If a woman wants to find a job at the time, like, couldn't she find a job that doesn't require her to be traveling all over the world?
Yes.
You know, I want to think that that's what she wanted to do, that she wanted to see the world, you know, rather than staying in the little town and, I don't know, pick up a sewing job or whatever.
Yes.
Cleaning, stuff like that. She was also not very young when she had
your mom. That's another thing.
That's another thing.
Maybe she loved her independence, but felt that she wanted a child. No, and she had a love affair with someone, and
she didn't marry the guy.
She didn't, but you know, we know him. We don't know him, but. I have all the photographs of him, and my mother told me that he supported her in her education.
Which is another really interesting thing.
He didn't abandon her.
Right.
But I think what happened was the war, the Second World War.
Mm.
And there was, that's what separated lots of people, you know. There was a crazy time.
Right, but the separation came because of the war, but not marrying. Again, we can only imagine, but she could have married him, but she didn't. Yes. For some reason, this woman was a very independent person.
Yes.
And it's not like she didn't have a relationship with him. They had relationship, but just didn't take the form of marriage.
Yes.
Which is for the time.
Yeah, yeah. It's quite unusual.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, I think you're right. Yeah, yeah. But, yes, I'd love to have known her. Mm-hmm. And
I want to know what birds she had seen during the trip.
Yes, I mean, she
must have seen lots of lifers, as we say.
She had. I've got one of her books, which is about ocean bird life and marine life as well.
So she must have been observing from the ship.
I wonder what she saw. She would have seen albatrosses, obviously, the birds of India. She went sort of touched on the countries of India and Australia. And I know she loved Japan. It was her favourite place in the whole world to go to.
It's kind of wild to think that she must have seen lots of Japanese birds.
There's a picture of a kookaburra in the album. Mm-hmm. She saw a kookaburra, and there was a coming back to Ireland, there's a little canary.
Right.
But what else? I know she had a little chipmunk as a pet.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was called Billy. I'm not sure, but it might have been called Billy. I've got a pencil sketch of it somewhere.
If you've just tuned in, today's guest is Rachel Winkworth, an artist and birder based in Montrose, Scotland. Thanks for listening. This is Bequency on WGXC, a special UK edition.
But anyway, so yes, birds connected us all through the ages. Mm-hmm. And it's
some of
lovely.
Those people of your great-great-grandmother or somebody gave your grandmother the bird book because she was 10.
Yes.
In 1904, whatever, that there was a handwriting in the book.
That's right, yes, yes.
So maybe your great, who would that be? Great, great grandma?
Yes, it
must
may
have
be.
Been possibly a birder.
Well, it could be. It would be lovely to know that.
Yeah. It's quite a beautiful history of birder family, I would like to say.
Yes, yes. And it's still. It still goes on, you know. My sister lives in Spain and she looks out for birds there and sees lots of, you know, blue rock thrushes and things like that. I'm very envious. And when I lived in France, I had a black woodpecker visit the garden on a few occasions. And I'd never seen one before, and I was absolutely thrilled to see a black woodpecker. Mm-hmm. And we had an old apple tree, which had it disintegrated almost, and we just had a stump about 6 foot tall left. And this black woodpecker would come, and its beak was enormous. You know, it was really long, and it was a huge woodpecker. And it would get right down at the base, and it would peck at this wood, which was rotten, and he reduced the stump to practically nothing within a few days. And then he came back occasionally over a couple more years. And then just before I left France to come and live in Scotland, I heard him calling in the woods.
Oh.
And it's quite an extraordinary call, and it's very distinguishable. And it was almost like a farewell, you know.
Mm.
It was quite sad to hear it, really.
Oh.
I never see it again. But there were lovely things like that to see in the garden there.
Yeah.
Crested tits that I'd never seen before. And we used to get red squirrels in the garden with their family of kittens, you know. And all sorts of lovely wildlife there.
Mm-hmm.
And just before I left France, about a winter before I left, I went down to a place near Avranches, which is on the coast of the Cherbourg Peninsula, just at the bottom, below the Cherbourg Peninsula. And I was down there on my own on a winter's day, and I was walking between these two reed beds with a gravel track in between, and I sort of went into a little sort of cavity of the gravel and stood there, and a bittern flew up right in front of my face.
Nice.
I could have almost touched it, this bittern, and I'd never seen one before in my life. And it flew up And I was just astonished to see it. And it flew away with great big flapping wings, you know. Mm-hmm. Oh, it was wonderful.
You have bits on in Scotland too? I saw it in Oxford Museum. Taxidermy,
yes,
not the real one.
Very rare, very uncommonly. I think there was one at Strathbeg, going back to the spring. Mm-hmm. We seem to have had a bittern explosion in the United Kingdom this last spring and summer.
Very nice.
There have been bitterns seen in all the nature reserves around England, it seems, and only a couple in Scotland. So it is quite uncommon here. But, those lovely things to see. Mm.
So it will be soon winter. We're doing this interview in late October.
Mm.
And in Aberdeen, we're doing this interview in Aberdeen.
Yes.
So around this area, is there any bird you're looking forward to seeing or coming months?
Yes, the waxwing, which is a beautiful bird. So smart. And it's... plumage is quite unique because it looks as smooth as smooth. It almost looks like it's modelled out of clay, you know, or porcelain or something, you know. And I'd only ever seen them once before in Woodstock in America.
Mm-hmm. In Hudson Valley.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But that was the American
cedar
version.
Cedar waxwing.
Yeah. But so I was really thrilled the year before last to see them in Montrose and Aberdeen.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope we see them again this winter.
Right. And those ones you mentioned, it's a Bohemian waxwing?
Yeah, I think so. Yes. Yes.
Because it's much north.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. They'd be coming from Scandinavia, I presume. Yeah. But there's all sorts of birds that I've seen here that... currently at Montrose Basin, which is the largest saltwater basin, or second largest, well, I think it's the largest in the UK, they're hoping for at least 80,000 pink-footed geese visit this winter.
Mm-hmm.
And we watched the skeins going over and the call of the wild goose, and that took me back to childhood when we lived at Ringwood. We'd, on a winter's night, my parents would... probably before we had television, maybe, and they'd say, we can hear them, and we'd all go outside into the garden, and we'd look up into the night sky, and I can't remember if they actually saw them, but these skeins of geese were going over, calling.
Mm.
Probably pink-footed geese again, I'm not sure. But it was like the call of the wild goose, and it took you back to childhood. You know, it's a lovely memory. Yeah. And
beautiful.
It's lovely.
Thank you so much for sharing all these beautiful stories.
Thank you very much for inviting me, and it's been a pleasure. And long live birding and the call of the wild goose.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
Those were the calls of pink-footed geese, recorded by Lawrence Shove in Scotland in 1969, and this recording is archived in the British Library. Thanks again to Rachel for all the beautiful stories that she shared with us. I guess it really is the power of observation, you know, the way she can tell these stories with such vivid detail, as if they happened only yesterday. And I was touched by how her memories of nature are so deeply intertwined with the people she loved, and that really reminded me of the fact that anything becomes special if only you cherish it, even an encounter with the most common bird, like Rachel said in the interview. So I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Rachel as much as I did. I'm posting the transcript of this recording, this interview, and also my past interviews with birders on the show Bequency, posting them on my Substack page. It is at bequency.substack.com. And you can see the old photos of Rachel's grandma and more photos of the old books that she was talking about, as well as a beautiful bird painting that she created, watercolor painting. And so I hope you check it out. And now it's time for the bird-inspired music of the month. We're going to hear a song by Kitchen Cynics and Marjorie Dow. This is actually Rachel's collaborative music project with Alan Davidson, who's based in Aberdeen. And the song is titled Grey Lady Morning from an album As Those Gone Before. Just came out last month from Cruel Nature Records. So, hope you enjoy. Thanks for listening. This is Bequency on WGXC 90.7 FM.
So softly you don't wake anyone. Come late morning, don't let on how the day began. Keep the midday sun for midday, let him keep his midday people too. I don't care too much for midday, I just like to lie in here with you. Come now, sleep now, Lady Grey. Hey, Lady Morning, whirling, turning, turn your eyes again a while. Again and smile. Lay safely silky on the pillow, shelter for a little from the wind. Help my sleepy morning glory, let the day go chasing far behind. Come. Thank you. go softly, not to wake the bitter memories of a bitter yesterday. Come now, sleep now, Lady Grey. Come in, Lady Morning, come in so softly, you don't wake anyone. Come, Lady Morning, don't let on how the day. Keep the midday sun for midday, let him keep his midday people too. I don't care too much for midday, I just like to lie in here with you. Come now, sleep now.
That was Grey Lady Morning, a track by Kitchen Cynics and Mercury Dow, which is, again, Rachel's collaborative music project with Alan Davidson, who is based in Aberdeen. Alan is also a very enthusiastic birder, and I went birding with him and Rachel a few times during my trip to the UK, and we did see pink-footed geese, huge flocks, like thousands of them, among a bunch of other cool stuff that they show me, like marsh harrier and lapwing and stuff like that. And when you go birding with someone, even if you just met that person, it's like you're hanging out with friends that you already know. And so I really had a great time. And it was a really nice surprise for me that I had many experiences like that during this trip to the UK, meeting many kind, generous, and knowledgeable birders. So now I'm thinking of going back there next year or something to do a whole series of Bequency UK edition. Maybe ambitious, but one can dream. And I think I have time to play one more track from this album. We're going to close today's show with a track titled The Four Trains That Killed Me, again by Kitchen Cynics and Mercury Dow. And that'll be it for my show today. You're listening to Wavebombs WGXC 90.7 FM, and this program has been Bequency Meet Bird People in Hudson Valley. Today just happened to be the UK edition, but in Hudson Valley, a bird-themed program that invites the local community to be inspired by the joy, beauty, and wisdom bird enthusiasts find in the nature of our neighborhoods. Every episode features an interview with local bird people, plus a free-form mix of sounds made by birds and humans inspired by birds, hosted by me, Mayuko Fujino. And Bequency airs every fourth Saturday of the month at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, so I hope you come back and join me again at the end of November. Have a great weekend, and see you next time.
Jump, jump, jump. Jump, jump, jump. Jump, jump, jump. Jump, jump, jump. Jump, jump, jump. Jump, jump.
Train that killed me made a friendly puffing sound, and we all waved out of the windows as it sped across the ground. Suddenly bounced right off the rails, and so I lost the wind out of my sails.
Atomized and gone.